The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday morning West Coast time space show program. And I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. A great program today with a really good documentary film. I've seen the trailer. I can't wait to learn how to see the full film and go see it. I'll tell you more about that in just a minute. This is a 60-minute format program. So if you want to call and talk to our guest, who I will introduce in just a second, or if you want to email us, watch your clock so that you can do so while we're still broadcasting. Again, this will be a 60-minute program. And check the schedule for the Sunday program, Tuesday program, Hotel Mars next week and Friday. But there will be no Sunday show. I believe next Sunday is Father's Day. So if I have my dates right, we don't do programs on Mother's Day and Father's Day. The toll-free number for today, 866-687-7223. Email, if you want to email us, as always, drspace@thespaceshow.com. If you are wanting to get our newsletter, the best way to do so is to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And I will enter your subscription, so to speak, although it's free. And it's a very, very short newsletter. It comes out every Monday morning, 6 a.m. West Coast time. And it won't clutter up your email box for sure. But you can get that information off of our upcoming show menu on the right and the Space Show website newsletter, which has a link to it in the upper right. Probably the most important thing to tell you is that we are a 501c3 nonprofit with our parent One Giant Leap Foundation. We are 100% listener supported, meaning all of you listening to this program live or on archives, with your contributions you support it and make the Space Show possible. As a nonprofit, if you are paying U.S. federal taxes, you do get a deduction for your gift. The easiest way to support us is with PayPal, but there is a PayPal plus more link in the upper right corner of our homepage, thespaceshow.com, and that tells you how to do PayPal, of course. Also, for those of you who use Zelle, the email address for Zelle is david@onegiantleapfoundation.org, which takes your contribution directly to our Chase One Giant Leap bank account. And then if you want to do old school and send a check, that's fine. Make it payable to One Giant Leap Foundation. It mails to our Las Vegas office, which is listed on the PayPal button on our website. But if you have trouble, just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. One more quick thing before we start. I do want to thank our sponsors. We do have sponsors and a billboard advertiser, Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Celestis, the National Space Society, and Dr. Chaim Ben-Arroya over at Rutgers for his great Lunar Development and Lunar Hab books. If you buy those off of his banner ad, Amazon makes a contribution out of his purchase price to the Space Show, which is always nice and helpful. If you would like to be a sponsor, you get the unlimited banner ad. You can change whenever you want. And on longer programs, I read out a PR message for each of these sponsors. As I said today, we're talking about a new documentary film. The title is It's Quieter in the Twilight. And the filmmaker, And I hope, Billy, I get your last name right. Don't shoot me if I get it wrong. Billy Miocci. He's an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker out of Ohio. I have seen the trailer for this film. It's fabulous. Billy has a love of history, space, and science, and has done a great job in spotlighting the story of Voyager, which we still talk about on the space show and which still has followers. So I'm going to introduce Billy to you and take it away. Billy, welcome to the space show. How are you today?
Thanks for having me, David. I'm good. And yeah, I'm excited to talk more about this documentary.
Is this documentary your Emmy Award-winning documentary, or what was the Emmy Award-winning documentary?
No, that was for one I did here, actually locally in Cincinnati. I live in Cincinnati.
Uh-huh.
That's what the Emmy's for.
How did you get the idea to do a film on Voyager and the title? I'm trying to associate the title with Voyager, so help us out here.
Sure. I had certainly an interest in Voyager. I mean, I knew the basics about it, and probably what I knew best about it was the gold record, you know, the record that was placed on both Voyager spacecraft that have sounds from Earth and music, and that's by the extent I knew about it. And you know, around the 40th anniversary of the Voyager mission, which was in 2017, there was an article written about this tiny team of engineers, most of whom have been with the mission since the 1980s, and it was about their dedication, and they're working out of this sort of nondescript office building. And I found that fascinating, that here they are in these, you know, drab cubicles, but they're piloting, you know, humankind's most ambitious space mission ever. You know, Voyager 1 and 2 are the furthest man-made objects in space, you know, out there in interstellar space, and here they are, foregoing retirement and promotions because they're so committed to this beautiful mission and adventure of exploration and discovery. And so that's how it started. I thought that was just a wonderful story right there. And that's how it began.
Did you go and meet the team? And how did you start it out? How did you decide on a script? I mean, sort of give us more.
I knew, you have to get permission from JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, to do something like this. So that's where it began. You know, I wrote up a sort of a proposal, the idea of just profiling this small team of engineers. And, you know, that got approved. But then, of course, you had to get the engineers to agree to it. And you know, they're engineers, and they're not used to the limelight. They're not used to cameras, so I think they were surprised that anyone was interested in making a documentary about them. But thankfully, you know, they agreed, and I probably some of them agreed reluctantly at first, again not wanting to be in front of cameras and all that, but. And then, you know, before we started filming anything, I went out and met them. And that's where I learned more about them. I learned what a diverse group of people they are from all corners of the earth, literally. I mean, one from South Korea, another from Colombia and Mexico, and they've come together as this team committed to this goal of going as far as we possibly can in space.
What's the significance of the title?
So it sort of serves two things. You know, Twilight, you know, the Voyager mission is in, it's sort of the twilight years of the Voyager mission. It's been going for over 40 years. It's in the certainly in the back half of its of its life, and then the twilight of the engineers themselves and the twilight of their careers and their lives. And quieter, you know, in the 80s, Voyager was sort of the mission, you know, the mission at JPL and NASA, and there was, you know, had all this media attention. I mean, those press conferences drew tons of attention, you know, when they were going by Uranus and showing the pictures of Neptune. And then when that ended, when those planetary flybys ended, you know, the media went away and didn't really know what became of Voyager throughout the 90s and, you know, the 2000s. So it's sort of, that's sort of what quieter is referring to, is that, you know, that attention has gone away, but here they are still toiling away in anonymity, keeping this mission alive for as long as they possibly can.
Do they have a termination date or a technical ending date or a funding ending date?
So when we were filming, they were hoping to get to 2027, which would be the 50th anniversary of Voyager. We just had a premiere screening of the film at Caltech, and the engineers were there, and they now believe they can keep the mission going until 2035.
Wow.
Which is insane, you know, because they were hoping maybe they could get to 50 years, but now that they think they can go another 8 years beyond that, which is pretty wild.
I can't even contemplate where it would be in 8 more years.
Both of them are traveling at like 37,000 miles an hour. That's how fast they're going. But even then, they're still not, in the grand scheme of the universe,
they're slow.
They're not that long way to go.
What's in the film? What do you show in the film? And kind of take us through the film without giving us any spoilers.
Sure.
Although we all know the ending because it's still going on.
It's still going, yeah. And the goal was to tell the human story of this mission and to get to know these dedicated engineers. So a lot of time is spent getting to know them and their own, you know, incredible journeys to get where they are. Like I said, you know, a lot of them come from different corners of the earth, and they had their own journeys to get where they are, you know. So there's that sort of parallel in the film. And then, of course, the film focuses on what they're doing in keeping the Voyager spacecraft alive and the tiny little decisions they have to make and tiny little tweaks that, you know, are, you know, the little ways they have to turn the spacecraft just enough to keep it, you know, in line with Earth so it doesn't just drift away and tumble out, you know, lose communication with Earth. There are all these tiny little things and tweaks that they have to do and decisions they have to make on, you know, do we turn off this heater to give us the power to keep going, or do we not, so to keep the instruments from freezing? There are all these little decisions that have to be made. So that's a big part of the film as well.
How far out is it, and how long is it taking their signals to reach Voyager?
Now they are, I think, so Voyager 1 is further than Voyager 2. You know, it's something like 150 astronomical units away from Earth. It takes, I think now for Voyager 1, it takes like 23 hours from a signal from Voyager 1 to Earth takes 23 hours, and then 23 hours from Earth back. So, and then Voyager 2 is about 18 or 19 hours for signal time. So if there's an issue on Voyager 1, let's say, you know, it takes 23 hours for Voyager 1 to send that issue, to let Earth know that there's an issue, and then another 23 hours for the engineers to get that, you know, fix, command, or whatever, for Voyager 1. So it takes, like, you know, 2 days to fix something. And, of course, being as far away as it is and as cold as it is and as little power as it has, time is precious, and they don't have a lot of time to deal with. So they're dealing with a lot of things to keep it going.
You have a note from Karen in Dallas? And Karen says, I know the answer is probably no, but can any of our space telescopes see either Voyager?
No. They are so far away. And actually, and this is actually another big part of the film, is there's only one antenna that can talk to Voyager 2, because Voyager 2 is in the southern hemisphere of the planetary plane. There's only one antenna can communicate with it, and that's in Canberra, Australia, the deep space network.
Right.
In Australia. And there's only one, and it's part of the film that antenna had to go down for maintenance for an entire year. Entire year where they can't fix Voyager 2 if something goes wrong. They could see if something went wrong, but if something did go wrong, they couldn't. There's nothing they could do. So that's a big part of the film as well, is how they get through that period of time.
For Voyager 1, what is there one antenna or multiple antennas that can see it?
I think, Voyager 1 is in the northern hemisphere. I believe all three, so there's three, one in California, Spain, and then the networks in Australia. I think all three can communicate with Voyager 1. But Voyager 2 is also colder and has more issues than Voyager 1. So it's, the engineers call Voyager 2 the problem child, the two of them.
But nothing can see it. James Webb or Hubble, they can't see
it
at all.
No, that would be amazing, but I don't think so.
Here's another question for you. This is from Ralph, and he's up in Denver. And he says, in the signal that Voyager 1 and 2 send back, can they tell you what they're seeing, or do they only send that spacecraft health-related signals?
I think they can. They're sending data, I think, of the atmosphere that they're going through, and that's some of that's a little over my head, technical wise. But they are both sending back information about the space that they're in. They're both beyond the heliosphere. The space where the solar wind slows down, and they can send information. So, it's not just we're in trouble. There is other information scientifically that they're sending that scientists, are certainly taking a look at.
But if they saw an alien ship investigating them to find out what the hell they were, they wouldn't be able to report anything like that.
No.
Go ahead.
They don't. And there's, the cameras have been turned, when they went by, the cameras have been off since 1989 for Voyager 2, when it went by Neptune, and they went off for Voyager 1 in, 1981, because Voyager 1 went by Saturn, then it went off and into interstellar space. But the cameras have been off for years.
You have a caller wanting to talk to you. Good morning, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, my name is Matt. I'm from Virginia.
Okay.
And I just had a question. Billy, I love the documentary, and I thought it was really interesting. You talk about the decisions that had to be made, and, do you turn off the heater, those kind of things. And I think there's an interesting parallel between that and documentary filmmaking. So I was wondering if there's anything that you had to make decisions about, and any ideas, any special moments that got left on the cutting room floor, so to speak?
That's a good question, Matt. Thanks for the call, and I'm glad you were able to see the film. I think that goes with any documentary or filmmaking. There's moments that you got to decide whether they're good for the story or not, and that's certainly the case with this film. There were moments. You wish you could put everything in there, but you want to keep people's attention span, so you try and find the best stuff you possibly can. So, that was definitely part of this.
Okay, great.
Thank you for your call, Matt.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Where can we see it? How do we see it, Billy?
You can rent or buy it on iTunes, or you can do it on Amazon. It's also available on Amazon.
Not on Netflix.
No, and it'll be on Hulu. I don't have the exact dates, but it will eventually be on Hulu.
It won't be in any local art theaters or anything like that. It's strictly an online deal.
It played in theaters in Los Angeles for a week when it was first released, which was May 19th. But yeah, that obviously that week is over. So now it's just available on demand.
How did it go in live theaters in Los Angeles?
I think it went well. You know, it's cool to see on the big screen. I wish it could have, you know, had a longer life in theaters. I think it went well.
Did you end up, after the documentary, having a favorite, either Voyager 1 or Voyager 2?
You know, a big focus of the film is really Voyager 2, because at the time we were filming, that was really the big issue. So most of the film's focus is on Voyager 2. Again, because they call it, you know, it's the problem child. So, I guess Voyager 2, it's... They're both a little engine that could, but I think more so Voyager 2.
I have another email. Excuse me. Linda is up in Seattle, and Linda says, "Is the crew that you talked to, are they the original crew when Voyager 1 and 2 were launched?"
One of them joined in 1978 during the Jupiter encounter. None of them were there on the day of launch, which was 1977. And then some of the others joined in the mid-80s. But none, like the original, you know, when they started, there were hundreds of engineers. And during its peak years, it might have even, which was, you know, during the 1980s, it might have even gone up into the thousands. So now, you know, it's dwindled down to just, you know, 12 of them, which I think now is even less than that. It might be 10 since we stopped filming. One or two have retired. So it's a tiny team from a huge team that it was.
But no one was there at launch date or were in the pre-dates of getting Voyagers ready.
Dr. Ed Stone, who we feature, you know, is featured in the film. But he's a project scientist, so he's not an engineer. But we do talk to him in the film, and he, you know, was there day one in 1972 when they first conceptualized this mission. And he just recently, within less than a year, stepped down.
Interesting. I have another one, Ken. Ken is from Houston, and he says, do you know what the budget is to keep this operating, and do they have to fight for that budget, or is it so small compared to what NASA spends or blows money on that it just squeaks by and nobody cares?
I think right now it's $5 million a year is the budget.
Yeah, that's minor for NASA, right?
Which is, I think it's very minor, and it's... I don't think they have to fight for it anymore. I know in the early 2000s, around 2004, it was almost canceled because they'd been going for so long and they hadn't seen anything. But, you know, right as they're getting, considering canceling it is when they, Voyager 1 sort of reached the end of the solar system and, you know, sort of found something, so they kept it going. I don't think at this point they don't have to keep fighting for it, and it is such a minuscule amount compared to some of the bigger missions that are going.
Holly in Boston, and by the way, if you are able to use the telephone, we'd much prefer phones over emails, as always, 866-687-7223. Holly in Boston says, in terms of the two Voyagers, what surprised you, or did you find any surprises?
I think going into this, I didn't know, like, where they were in the universe. I didn't know they were in separate hemispheres. I didn't know Voyager 1 was up north and Voyager 2 was way down south.
Yeah, by the way, I didn't know that either. So.
Yeah. And I didn't know there was only one antenna on the planet that can talk to Voyager 2. So that was surprising. I didn't know that the power margins, you know, the amount of power that both of these spacecraft has, it's always on the edge of, like, running out of power. And that goes back to the, you know, tiny decisions they have to make, you know, do we turn off this heater or not? And since filming stopped, so each instrument that's still working had a heater. But they've had to turn off all those heaters to conserve the power. So none of the instruments have heaters on anymore, but they're still functioning, which is pretty wild considering how cold they all are, but they're still working.
So they're running off of nuclear power, right? These have RPGs on board.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea, did they tell you what the remaining life is of those RTGs that are on board?
I think they lose like 4 watts of power a year. I don't, you know, if they can keep going until 2035, I would guess that's the remaining life, or they expect it has that much life. I don't know the exact, you know, wattage that they have, or but they're constantly losing power and having to balance how do we add more power or keep it going.
Bill, here's another email. Bill is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he says, is the end for these missions that they just keep going and going and going like an ever-ready battery, except there's no tracking of it, no power,
correct,
nothing anymore?
Exactly. So they'll just, yeah, we just won't be able to communicate with them anymore, but they'll just keep going. On the same trajectory that they're both on now, they will keep going forever, which is pretty cool. I mean, they'll never stop. They'll just go further and further and further and further. Unfortunately, we won't know where they are.
So if they don't have power, there's no way for us to find them anymore because we can't detect them, correct?
Right, right.
Well, that's not
but
fair.
I know. But they'll keep going. And it's something like, I'm probably getting this wrong, but it's something like in 40,000 years is when it'll get to the next closest star or something like that. It's some mind-boggling figure. Just sort of speaks to the emptiness of space.
Unless something goes up to intercept it, and we'll never
right.
know about that.
Yeah, right. Which, you know, who knows? That's why those gold records are on there in hopes that something would find it.
You have another caller on hold. Good morning, caller. Thank you for your call. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, David. This is John in Fremont, California.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. This is a great, great show. I pretty much grew up with Voyager, and was real excited about it. I remember when it went by Neptune, they had a PBS special Neptune All Night, and I stayed up until, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning to see the data when it came in. So I was just wondering, on the RTGs, does the documentary talk about them? I mean, this is just incredible technology that we have, and it's really the only way to power spacecraft in the outer solar system. And I know we don't like to get into politics on the space show, but, you know, there's been resistance to nuclear-powered spacecraft in the past. There were big protests when Cassini was launched because of the RTGs. And I'm just wondering if you talk about the RTGs in the documentary and what incredible technology they are.
I didn't go too much in depth on the RTGs. That wasn't, you know, beyond just talking about their dwindling power supply. But they are, I mean, it is amazing technology. It absolutely is.
Yeah, and so what instruments are left, and what data are we getting back now? Do you talk about that?
Yeah, I have to look at I have to look up the exact names. I mean, there's the Cosmic Ray Subsystem. That's the one I know offhand. But there are five instruments on each spacecraft that are still functioning. Let me see. Yeah, there's the ultraviolet spectrometer, the low-energy charged particle. I'm not a scientist, and sort of this was more the human aspect of the mission, so I couldn't exactly speak to what information they are gathering.
No problem. That's okay. So the golden record, can you talk about that? I mean, did the engineers have any contribution on that, or was that all Carl Sagan, or how did that come together on the documentary?
The engineers didn't. That was more Carl Sagan and his crew, but it's this really beautiful, romantic aspect of the Voyager mission. It's this record filled with life on Earth, sounds of humans and sounds of animals and music, Bach, and it's just this slice of planet Earth that is traveling with both spacecraft way out into the universe. It's a really special feature.
What
of this
form
mission.
Is the, when you say record, most of us from that era think of a 33 and a third vinyl. What form was the record in?
It might be in that. I don't know exactly.
John, do you know? I don't think it was digital back then, so I don't know. Do you, John?
I actually do not know, but I have a book on it. I'd have to dig it out.
Well, if you find it, will you take the time one of these days to post it on the blog? Something tells me that the reason it's called a golden record was it really was a golden record.
Yeah, it is.
It was not a flash drive or anything like that.
No. Yeah, it's an actual record.
Yeah, so... how they play it, or how they would get the info off of it, that's another story. I don't think they sent a record player along with it.
No, but they did. They did. There are instructions that, you know, and of course they don't, not knowing what would encounter it, they tried to make it as plain language as possible for if someone were to encounter it, to hopefully figure out how to play it, but there are instructions along with it.
Yeah, and I hope they said we don't taste good someplace in that in that golden record. John, do you have other questions?
No, I'm looking forward to seeing it. It's on Amazon. I'm probably going to rent it real soon. So thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, John, when you were young and Voyager was going on, did you have any concept or anything that Voyager would, or hear any comments from the team or anything, that it would keep going and going and going and enter interstellar space? Because I don't remember any of that at the time.
Well, I remember hearing about, you know, after the mission was going to be over, that it would be the first, interstellar spacecraft, and they did talk about tens of thousands of years before it would encounter another star system. I remember reading about that, but it was all about the data at that time. It's just fantastic photography, and just the first time we'd ever done a grand tour of the planets, and it's such a really exciting concept to think about. Okay, we can visit most of the planets in the solar system. We got to get on this because you know, the opportunity doesn't arise that often. Do you talk about that in the documentary about, once in a lifetime opportunity to visit all the planets?
Yes, it's once every 176 years or something like that, and you know, that 176 years comes up right as we're in the space age, which is remarkable. And right as they're figuring out, hey, we can send a spacecraft to do that, it's you know, right when those planets line up. That is discussed in the film, which is fascinating.
Yep. So great documentary. Thank you so much for doing it,
John.
I look forward to seeing
If you do see it in the near future and you can remember, post a review on the blog about it.
Okay, I'll do that.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, listeners. We're available for your call. The line is free, 1-866-687-7223. Here's an interesting question. This is Tim, and Tim is in Los Angeles. By the way, you're in Ohio, right?
Correct.
Tim says, I'm a high school student. I'm out of school for today, and I did not know the film was in Los Angeles. I would have loved to have seen it. For today's students, for today's space program, and for the future, can you think of any lessons learned from Voyager?
Lessons learned in terms of what it, the information it gathered? Is that the question?
Well, I think you have a free spirit here to interpret as you want. He didn't say, if I were interpreting it, is there anything about the mission or the way it was developed or anything that can benefit people, students, others today and going into the future? Because this is a remarkable machine that we invented that is still many, many decades later giving us information. There's got to be something in there as a guide or a model or an incentive for the future. So I think that's my take on what he means, lessons learned.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, certainly the technology in terms of keeping a spacecraft going. But I would also say lessons learned is that this was a mission, I think, built off pure human curiosity, innate curiosity to see what is out there. Let's go as far as we can. And that's what this mission is built on, and that's what I love about Voyager. And I think that's what we can take moving forward on future missions, is that curiosity to find what else is out there, and that spirit of discovery and adventure. That's what I would take away from Voyager.
Then I take it you'd be a strong proponent of an exploration-oriented space program.
Yeah, absolutely.
This was a government mission, and at the time, government was all there was for space. Do you have any thoughts on whether these missions should be involving the private sector, should be carried out on a commercial basis, or on some kind of maybe government-private sector partnership? Or do taxpayers need to fund them on indefinitely into the future?
I mean, I think a partnership would be good, but I think,
I guess what I'm asking you is that we hear a lot of people objecting to the space program because they say there's better uses for the money.
Right.
You know, and you've heard it all before like everybody else has. Are there better uses for the money, or does this justify the use of the money?
That's a tough question. I think there's some justification for a mission, certainly like Voyager, where you are trying to understand this universe that we are a part of and that we know so little about. I think that's a worthy mission to learn about what surrounds us, being this rock in the middle of nowhere. So I would say so. I would say yes, that there's certainly worth in that, and there's worth in furthering that knowledge. Yeah, that would be my answer to that.
Yeah, it would probably be mine as well. Do you see space in this kind of a mission? I think it's probably lost today, but maybe at the time Voyager was launched and active, it was sort of a unifying thing with people from all over the place, kind of like some of the early space programs. That seems to be missing a lot in some of today's space programs. Does Voyager help make that come back, or how could space carry that characteristic back today that it had from a couple of decades ago?
It was born out of that special time of space exploration,
right?
You know, when it seemed like, well, let's try everything. Let's try everything we possibly can with this technology that we have. It would be great to see a mission come back that had the kind of ambition that Voyager has had and still has. But I don't know. Voyager, it's over 45 years old now, and there are, you know...
It's a different world,
It is a different world, and it's, you know... Voyager is sort of forgotten, which was, again, sort of the point of this documentary, was to spotlight this forgotten mission and the forgotten people still working on the mission. I would hope this film sort of inspires that and reignites that enthusiasm for that sort of ingenuity and the spirit of curiosity and discovery.
A couple of weeks ago, I was at a National Space Society conference, the ISDC, as they call it, and the keynote speaker on Saturday night was Eric Smith, who's the head of the James Webb Space Telescope team, and he sat at the table that I was sitting at, and I and everyone else at the table was talking to him, and it seemed to me that his team, which is really not that big, but his team at James Webb has embodied what you're talking about. And I haven't seen the film, and maybe what the film encaptures, but James Webb has not been deployed for 1 year yet. So I don't know what it would be like 45 years after deployment. If that spirit would still be there, if some of the original James Webb people will Steve still be there? NASA wants to shut down Hubble, so it's unclear if any of these space telescopes with today's technology could last 45 years. I think those missions have the chance of doing that, and Eric Smith seemed to embody this energy, but 45 years? Boy, I don't know. You have a caller on hold, but that's something to contemplate. Could a really great inspirational mission today have that kind of longevity in today's world?
Right.
I hope it does. Let's see who your caller is. Good morning, caller. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you for calling us.
Yeah, hey, it's Bill calling from Raleigh.
Hi, Bill.
Hi. David, I think your comment about the James Webb telescope is an interesting parallel. I was thinking about another parallel. and that is the recent documentary that I think got a fair amount of attention in the public, and that's Goodnight Avi. And it seems like this film is kind of covering something of the same ground for, you know, the end of, basically looking toward the end of a mission, if not actually seeing the end, but looking toward the end of a mission. And also looking at two spacecraft that were launched at the same time and, you know, had parallel lives, but kind of went in different directions. I wondered if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a parallel there. I have not seen Goodnight Afi, but you know, I've certainly read about it. Know generally what it's about, but yeah, there's absolutely a parallel there. You know, these. I know with that Goodnight Afi, that was again a spacecraft that wasn't expected to last as long as it did. And that's certainly the case with Voyager. You know, originally Voyager was only supposed to be a 4-year mission, and it was only supposed to go by Jupiter and Saturn. It has gone far beyond that, for sure. But yeah, these both have these dedicated teams, you know, committed to keeping these spacecraft going as long as they can for the sake of knowledge and exploration.
Yes, and you also mentioned that Voyager 2 is the problem child. It was kind of interesting in Goodnight Afi that the problem child in that film was actually Spirit, and which the problem child in that case wound up not getting all the attention, and the good child got all the attention. So, but I really look forward to seeing this documentary. It sounds very interesting, and I think those of us that were, you know, kind of watching this thing all our lives will get a lot out of it.
How long does the film last? Can you tell us that?
It's, it's 83 minutes.
Okay.
Just under an hour and a half.
Are you in the film or just in the shadows making the film?
Yeah, I'm just in the shadows.
Okay. Bill, what else is on your mind?
That's it for me. Thanks for taking the call.
Thank you for the call in. Listeners, we can still take your call. We got about 11 minutes for our program today. 866-687-7223. Did this turn you into an absolute bona fide dedicated space cadet, and are you planning another space documentary?
It's certainly I wouldn't say made me a space cadet, but you know, I've always certainly been fascinated by you know, space and the missions that have taken us there. My next documentary has nothing to do with space.
What is it about?
It's generally, well, it's really about this woman. She was the founder of Seoul Newspaper, which was big in the 70s, and it has to do with her life and her extraordinary life, not just with Seoul Newspaper, but much more beyond that, which I will leave for now.
Okay. Ken, I'll just read his email. Ken is in San Francisco. Ken says, we all wonder about the commercial value of different things with space. How do you assess the commercial value of a space documentary like this compared to other documentaries and what you've seen in the industry? Do space documentaries make any money? Are they as good a money makers as other genres, or are they sort of on the lower end of things?
I don't know the exact answer to that. I think, you know, it's broadly speaking, space is a fairly, general interest topic that I think a lot of people would have an interest in. I don't know the answer to that, whether it's, you know, I'm not making millions of dollars off this documentary, I can say that, but I would hope there's an interest, particularly in what Voyager continues to accomplish.
Well, did you, let me see if I can ask Ken in another way, did the amount of money potential that you could make on this documentary influence your making it, or did you want to tell
no.
the story?
Yeah, not at all. Interested and fascinated by their story, the team of engineers, and thought it was a story that should be brought to a wider public.
So even if its commercial value were known to be not so great, you would have pushed forward to make the film?
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you entered it in film festivals? How's it doing if you have done so?
Yeah, we premiered at South by Southwest in 2022. And then we played at festivals here and all over the world before it was picked up by Gravitas Ventures, who's our distributor, who put it in theaters and now made it available on demand.
Did it do well in the film festivals?
Yeah, it did. That was a thrilling experience to watch it with an audience and experience it with an audience. And that was to hear their reactions to it. That was
as the director, did you answer questions from them?
I did. Yeah, we did. You know, all the screenings I went to, there were Q&As after the film.
So, what kind of questions did you get? Are they technical and knowledgeable about space, or were they general? What can you say about the audience?
There was a mix, I think. And then some of the screenings, some of the engineers featured in the film were there, and they certainly got the technical questions, stuff that I, you know, couldn't really answer.
Uh-huh.
Questions directed to me were more, you know, how did you find the story, and you know, more the process of the filmmaking, and that was more the stuff that I was answering.
Sherry in Dallas, a second Dallas listener, wants to know if working with JPL was easy or challenging.
It was challenging because we were pretty restricted on what we were given access to. There were certain things we couldn't film. There were only a certain amount of hours each day that we were allowed to be on site. And we were only given a certain amount of days total that we could be on site. So we had to work around that, those parameters, which was definitely a challenge. But, I mean, overall, they were a great partner and very supportive. But they're just, you know, things that, you know, I expected going into it, that, you know, we weren't going to be able to sort of embed with them for weeks at a time. So we had to work around those things.
Did they have to review the film before you could release it? Did they have any review rights or anything like that?
No. We did send it to them, you know, before we premiered at South by Southwest, just so they, you know, they could see, and they could also check for accuracy, make sure that, you know, what we were portraying and what was being said in the film was accurate. But they didn't have any sort of creative control or, you know, that sort of thing.
Billy, we're coming up on the end of our hour. What should I have asked you about, or what have we missed, or what have we omitted, or what else would you like to tell us about this documentary, which everybody we're talking to wants to go see it, myself included. So what have we missed? And then I have a sort of a little question on my part. You mentioned earlier you wish everyone could see it on the big screen. If I watched it on an iPhone, would I be cheating myself?
No, you can. However people can see it, I think that's great. I don't think you'd be cheating yourself.
You don't think the size of the image would be that bad on the iPhone?
No, I watch lots of things on my iPhone these days. I think you'd be just fine.
What have we forgotten, or what else would you like to tell us?
I don't think we've forgotten anything. I just would, I think this, just to reiterate, this film, it's less a history of the Voyager mission and more a story about the people. It's the human side of this incredible mission, and it's a peek into their dedication. This team that has shied away from the limelight all their years, and it's a chance for them to tell their important, essential stories.
You got an 11th hour email, and her name is Harriet in New York City. And Harriet said, among the people that you interviewed, do you find that there was an overriding common mutual binding theme with all of them? Or did they all have their own story and their own reasoning and motivation, but somehow they worked together as a great team?
That's a great question. I think there is a sort of similarity between all of them. I mean, they've all sort of overcome their own adversities to get where they are, and fought and sort of clawed to get to this mission, to work on this mission. And now that they're all together, they're committed to this goal of keeping this mission going, but they're doing so, if the similarity is that they sort of overcame their adversities, they each overcame different adversities, so they're bringing their diverse experiences to this goal of maintaining and keeping this mission going.
You didn't notice any tensions or anything like that?
No, they all get not at all. They all get along really well. They've worked with each other for years, but there might be some, as you might expect with people who work with each other for a long time, but they all get along very well.
Do they have families, or is the team their family?
They do all. They all have families, but Voyager has certainly become a part of that family. Each of their families. One of the engineers, Soon Kang Matsumoto, she says, her kids, when they were little, would ask, "How's Voyager?" as if they're asking, "How's Grandma?" They'd all.
So cool.
Yeah.
And so the kids probably are up on Voyager and how it operates and have a lot of great knowledge. Hopefully they go forward and use it in a way that education has not been lost on them. That's real special education. Did you interview any of the children?
Soon Kang Matsumoto's son, we interviewed him, and he had built a small Voyager model out of Legos that Soon keeps on her desk. He built it when he was, a little boy, but she's always kept it.
How old is he now?
He's now in his early 20s.
What's he doing? Did he go into engineering or space or anything?
No, I think he's in the military, in the Air Force.
Air Force, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very cool. So, listen, I'm really glad you brought this to our attention and that you guys contacted me by email out of the blue, because I was not aware of any of this until I got your email. So I really appreciate your outreach, and I can't wait to go see the film. So thank you for being with us, and if you have something else you think we might be interested in, you know how to reach me, because I'd love to talk with you and cover you on more of your projects and more of your work.
Thanks, David. I appreciate it, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
Okay, and when I get this archived, I'll send you the links to it. It'll be up and running on the Space Show website later today, but the summary that I post probably won't be up and running until tomorrow. But this has been informative and also an awful lot of fun. And when I get a chance to see it, I'll send you back my comments. And thank you again for bringing this to our attention.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, listeners, weekend is here. Keep it safe. Have a lot of fun. As always, keep looking up. And we want to thank everyone who called and everyone who emailed. And we want to thank Billy for sure and his crew that made this great film. And also the Voyager crew, although they have nothing to do with this space show program, but there wouldn't be this program without them. So we want to thank them too. And we have a next show on Sunday and Tuesday, so look at our newsletter. We're back up to speed after ISDC. Once again, everybody, have a great weekend. Goodbye from Billy, David, and the Space Show.